Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of our program, Dare to Be Different. It's just wonderful to have you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming midway 1548 Satellite Islam. And also welcome to our listeners via the DSTV on DSTV bouquet 826. And looking at the weather, you know, it's so topsy-turvy. We've been having some wonderful warm days. Then we've had cold days and warm, and now it's cold again. And I'm not even sure how to read the weather any longer. But nevertheless, many of us are raring to go out gardening, and we want him to do so many things in our garden. Whilst we do understand that we have challenges around water, we have water shortages, water restrictions, is it time for us to say that we're not going to be doing any gardening, or are we going to become more prudent and find ways and innovative ways of gardening? And this morning we're going to be chatting to Andrea. Now, Andrea is no stranger. She lives in one of the most beautiful parts of the country, and that's out in the southern part of the Cape, near the Knysna Forest, and really surrounded by nature, and she's always so inspirational, sharing so much with us. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning to you.
Thank you very much. You sound very, very, very lively. What's the weather like? And outside, we're all wrapped up for winter.
My goodness. Well, over here, it's absolutely beautiful. We've been having marvelous spring weather. Unfortunately, not very much rain. Yeah, the weather is a little bit topsy turvy. We normally expect to still have quite a bit of chill at this time of the year. But it's actually lovely. The tourists are starting to come. They're enjoying the beautiful weather. Sea's still too cold for swimming. But, yeah, it's looking lovely around the place. And all the little bit of rain that we have had seems to have at least managed to refresh the natural vegetation to a certain extent.
And have you had your normal rainfall, or is it more sparse this year?
It seems to me to be quite a lot more sparse. I don't have actual rainfall figures to look at, but you know, we're accustomed to basically year-round rainfall, with quite a lot of it falling here towards the end of the winter, often days on end of lovely light rain that really, really penetrates the soil, that flushes through the estuaries and takes away the mosquitoes and so on. But I'm already seeing mosquitoes, so I think I'll take that as a sign that there hasn't been quite as much rain as we would have liked.
And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said that weather is a very good indicator of the type of rains we're going to get. Now, have you been able to follow that? You know, they said that we build, if birds build a nest high up, the fork croak, and, you know, they've given us some of that type of indication. Have you ever been able to follow up with that and say that in nature we do have these, you know, sort of indicators, and to a certain extent, they're good to follow and would tell us what's happening with our weather patterns. Is that correct?
Well, you know, animals and birds do seem to pick up on what is going to happen with the weather, but generally they seem to me to notice it. Well, this is just my personal opinion, but there might be research to prove me wrong, but they seem to notice it just before the event. I mean, I remember about a decade ago there were those terrible tsunamis in Thailand and that part of the world. And animals, apparently, before the tsunami already, were fleeing. They were heading to the higher ground before people ever realized what was going to happen. My pets will be inclined to pick up on electricity in the air. So before there's any thunder or lightning, they start to become very disturbed. You can see they're not happy. They start complaining and so on and so on. And you're wondering, what's wrong? And then suddenly there'll be a clap of thunder. But they actually start before the thunder strikes. So I think they do have a good idea. I always rely on the birds to let me know when the rain's actually stopped, because here we get the sort of intermittent rain where it rains and it stops and it rains and it stops. And the birdies are actually quite good at figuring out when they can come out. So they'll be all very quiet, all lying low while the rains are on the go. And when you hear them all starting to come out, and they're all busy chirping and calling, then you know that the rain's over. And of course over here we also have a beautiful bird called the Birchall's Cuckoo, also known as the rain bird. They say when you hear that bird calling, it's going to rain. I'm not sure about that one. I'll have to check that one out.
Well, thank you very much you know, for that. And also looking at the weather patterns and nature and so forth, have you found something, you know, over the last couple of years there's been a dramatic shift? And is climate warming a reality in your part of the world, or is this still very much where people are coming and scientists are saying it is happening, and have they been able to measure it? Do you think that's a reality on your side?
I'm afraid, you know, the differences in climate have become so marked that none of us can be in denial, no matter how optimistic we may be. We can definitely notice warmer temperatures. We can definitely notice that there are more heat waves. And I'm seeing a change in the rainfall pattern. There are some academics who believe that winter rainfall will ultimately be put to an end, which would be a huge disaster certainly for the Western Cape and for our very unique Cape floristic region. So that winter rainfall does dry up, which some experts are predicting. Our vegetation just won't have time to adapt, given the kind of speed they're busy talking about there. You know, I mean, plants can adapt, but it takes them many hundreds of years to figure out, you know, well, this genotype is going to survive or that genotype is going to survive. And everything here is very much geared to that winter rainfall. So I do hope that the very worst predictions do not pass, but there are indeed definitely signs of climate change. And much as we might like to pretend it isn't there, I'm afraid it's all too real.
Now, you know, we're in an in-between season. We're not really truly into summer. We've just left winter behind, and we have the two phenomena, the La Nina and El Nino. And looking at what has come out, and they said, look, fine, we're not too sure whether it's the end of the one and the beginning of the other. Have you picked up any of that?
Well, yes, I have been sort of reading what the experts are saying, and they all seem to be saying different things. So I'm afraid we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yes, you know, because when you think of, you know, what's happening, and I must say too that whilst we are looking at our, you know, own weather patterns in South Africa, you find there's been lots of floods in different parts of the world, soaring temperatures in Europe, and, you know, in other parts, you know, it hasn't been normal. So there has been that shift of weather patterns internationally, and I think we do see some of that having an impact on us here in South Africa.
Definitely, and that's all reason to get out there and plant trees.
I beg your pardon?
I say it's all the more reason to get out there and plant trees. Look, I mean, it's like turning a ship. You can't turn a ship very quickly. A ship can't swerve. It takes a long time to get this turn done. And one of the ways that we can help the world to turn around is to reduce emissions. Now, obviously, that does mean things like, you know, not taking unnecessary trips by car and things like that. And being careful about how we, as consumers, work when we go shopping. Don't buy overpacked items. Think about, do you really need something? Because everything that you buy, there's emissions attached to it. So minimizing our carbon footprint can be controlled through our consumer habits. But one of the things that we really can do to reverse what damage we're forced to make is to plant trees. And if we don't have space to plant trees, there are a lot of wonderful community projects that you can actually have trees planted in undergreened areas. There's one down here in the Cape that's busy rehabilitating absolutely fabulous ancient forest known as Platbos Forest. And this is a completely a non-profit organization. And you donate event and you guarantee that a tree will be planted either in Platbos Forest, you can specify, or if you would prefer to plant fruit trees at schools or something like that, you can specify that. Wonderful, wonderful organization. They use a lot of humor in their marketing, which I find very amusing. It's rare to find environmental charities actually using humor. They're bringing across a very, very serious message, but they manage to do it in a way that you laugh and then you'll think about it afterwards, which I find very, very innovative on their part. So yes, there's always a way to plant a tree, even if you don't have room.
Thank you very much for that. And just on that particular note, we are in the last couple of weeks, we've been able to manage, together in partnership with the Lens Going Green and IHV and a number of other organizations, were able to put, you know, I beg your pardon, together with the Department of Forestry, I think that was the department that came on board, and do 2,500 trees that we got out to schools, to religious sites, to sports grounds. And I thought it was a fantastic initiative on their part to donate these trees and also to get recipients to take over the trees. You know, it's not just about planting the trees, Andrea. It's also to get people to take ownership of these trees, because you can plant the trees, and if there's nobody going to be looking out, you sometimes find people pulling them out while they're still young and saplings, and you have those type of challenges.
Absolutely. You know, the whole ownership thing is very, very important. Some of the most successful schools tree planting initiatives I've seen have been coupled with environmental education for the children, as well as designating certain groups of children to actually take care of the trees for themselves. And that's not just good for the trees. I think it's also very beneficial for the children.
Yes, and when you look at that, you know, again, whilst talking on trees, do you think it's too late, or can you start, or is something about, or could trees be planted throughout the year? Just help us with that one.
Yes, they can, but I will say that summer is the most unfavorable. Summer and midwinter, those two are the more unfavorable times of the year for tree planting. Yes, you can plant at almost any time of the year, but if you're going to choose, for example, summer, when your main enemy is going to be drying out, of your young tree with its limited little root ball, then you will want to choose probably a bigger, stronger plant with a bigger container size, deeper roots, and your aftercare will have to be that much more intense. And as we know, with water shortages at the moment, yes, I would be inclined to say you can still do it now, definitely. Your trees will have a couple of months to settle before the very hottest weather hits. But actually, to tell you the honest truth, my very favorite planting season is autumn. It's not a very fashionable time for planting trees, but it gives the roots time to settle before the winter weather comes in. Extreme heat, extreme cold, the two things that plants are now obviously not at their happiest with. They'll be adapted to the sort of middle road rather than the most extreme. I like the mild season. Spring and autumn are both good.
So we still have a couple of weeks in which we could still, you know, encourage people to go out there and plant trees if they're wanting to. And, of course, to donate your tree to a place, even if you cannot plant a tree in your own space or in your own environment, to plant it in or give it to an organization that would willingly receive the tree and plant it on your behalf. Is that right?
Yes, there are. There are many organizations that do that. There are at least two NGOs in this country that I know of that are really big, that are working countrywide. And are accepting donations. They're very clever. They get donations also from the big tree growers, the nurseries. So that really the money that you donate mainly goes towards the logistics of getting the tree to the place, getting, you know, the necessary tools and so on together. A lot of these tree planting organizations use volunteer labor to do it. So even if you don't have enough money to donate, you can also volunteer, which I think is also a lovely way of giving something back and helping to minimize your carbon footprint.
You know, just on the carbon footprint, you know, this is the time when many people are planning and wanting to go out of the country, flying out of the country, and, you know, that about the carbon emissions and so forth. I think it's a wonderful idea if you are going to be traveling by plane and you are so many people, then to say, look, fine, we'd give back and plant 5 trees or 10 trees or even 2 trees. I think, you know, if each one just does that, we'd be helping to, as you indicate earlier, turn around to a certain extent. Is that right?
Every little bit helps. You know, I was reading the most inspiring story about a guy who was a filmmaker, and he was doing a documentary on worldwide football development, and he traveled many thousands of kilometers by plane with his team in order to get the sort of international documentary together. And he started thinking about his carbon footprint, and I'm not quite sure. I think there are carbon footprint calculators online and so on. And he and his friends went, and they found out that they would need to plant 6,000 trees to make up for their world round trip that they did while filming this documentary. And they decided to mobilize friends, family, and just generally interested people in the community to get involved and get their 6,000 trees planted. And it was supposed to be a month-long initiative and then be over and done. But one thing led to another, and now 10 years later, they're still doing the same thing, planting trees.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Now, you know, talking about trees, and when we talk about trees, do we talk about trees that are indigenous, trees that are indigenous endemic, and also the debate about should we be planting a lot of, edible fruit trees, you know, where we can get the fruit of them and sustain communities? Take us with that.
Well, I love indigenous plants. I'm very much keen on them. I'm not a purist, but I'll certainly say that, for example, in George, oak trees, very, very popular. I've seen them also in Stellenbosch, very, very popular. At one point, everybody was growing oak trees. But now the fact of the matter is our climate isn't very good for oak trees. So what happens is in the springtime, they come out, they come into beautiful, fresh green leaf, and within a couple of weeks, they've got downy mildew, and they're actually looking pretty sick, and the leaves are starting to yellow and so on. So, I mean, that is a typical example of planting a tree outside of its natural habitat where it will grow. It will get very old, and it will grow okay, you know. But it's just not at its happiest. In the dry areas of the country, you might not even have that much success. So I like to say with your ornamental trees, your shade trees, we have very many beautiful indigenous trees. We have one of the most carbon-fixing trees in the entire world in our natural plant palette, which is, by the way, the spekboom, which is basically a succulent tree. Quite interesting, one of the world's best carbon sequestrators. So the ornamentals, definitely go for something indigenous. Go for something ideally that matches your rainfall pattern and your climate. Because, well, yes, you know, if I go and plant a tree that's coming from KZN, it will probably find the climate here a little bit too cold and it won't do as well as it should. And then, of course, fruit trees. Wonderful. Wonderful way to reduce your carbon footprint. The more food that you can take out of your garden, petrol is being used or diesel is being used to cart foods long distances to supermarkets, putting it in cold storage for weeks and weeks and weeks. All of this is using energy. All of this is causing emissions. What you grow in your own garden not only reduces your carbon footprint, it also is very, very healthful and much, much tastier.
You know, you mentioned something, and I think we've done this before, and that was the speck worm. Whilst it's not a tree, it's a wonderful way of cleaning the air. Tell us something about this this particular the shrub, and where is it available, and what are the benefits?
Oh, it's a fabulous plant. There are very many forms of it. There's three forms that grow almost like a ground cover. One of them is variegated with three colors, rather slow growing, but very pretty. With a sort of pinkish stems and then white and green, round little, like little round button sleeves. And then there's another one that's green that does the same thing, and a gold one that does the same thing. Sort of like a little cascading shrub. And then you also get the ones that most people are more familiar with, the small rounded leaves, upright, succulent, very dramatic growth habit. I'm very fond of them. I've got quite a few in my garden. And they really do make quite a nice statement. You can do various things with them. You can turn them into hedging. They make fabulous hedging. You can grow them as freestanding feature plants with that exciting growth habit. They really make a very attractive feature plant. You can grow them as bonsais if you really have no space, but then you'll probably have to grow quite a lot of bonsais to clean the air. And then there's also a third variety with really, really big leaves. It looks almost more like the jade plant, but it is a speck worm, and that form is a genetic form that occurs, as far as I understand, in the Karoo, where they get both the small round-leafed one and then this other big round-leafed one. That one's the fastest grower. I kind of like the little leaves. I think they're very, very pretty, and they have a very nice, soft effect. But the big-leafed one is very vigorous and grows very fast indeed.
And are they good as indoor plants? Because I'm just looking at offices and so forth, you know, because we need to keep that environment clean and pure and so forth. Is the speck worm good for indoors?
Fabulous, fabulous. It likes good light. I actually had one indoors that I kept indoors for around about 6 months. It was quite good light, but it wasn't direct light. And it thrived. It really did very, very well indeed. I took it outside later, but it was more for reasons of interior decoration than because the plants actually needed it. So yes, they can thrive indoors. It's actually amazing what will thrive indoors. But the speck worm is one of them. It can do very well. It just needs good light and don't overwater it, which is the little funny thing that we do with our indoor plants. We underwater often our outdoor plants and overwater our indoor plants. So always remember to get your hands dirty. Put your finger in there and feel if the plant actually needs water.
And when you go into a nursery, what do you ask? Do you ask for a speck worm, or what do you do? Or what do you tell the garden
center? Speck worm, elephant food, portula caria. It goes under so many names. And really, it's such a well-known plant that any garden center worth salt will know what you want if you walk in there and say you want a speck worm. And the lovely thing about this naughty tip, when you buy one, you can have as many as you want because they grow very easily from cuttings, even large pieces. So if you have somebody who's got a couple on their farm in the Karoo or something like that, you can just go and cut truncheons literally a meter long and go and stick them in your garden. They'll suffer for a little while, then they'll take root and they'll grow. So really, really easy to grow. My problem with them is every time I prune them, I've got all these little prunings, and I feel sorry to waste them because I know they'll all grow. So then I plant them all, and I end up with hundreds of speck worms to give away.
Well, your environment must be very pure then, Andrea. You must be having fantastic air around there because you've got so many of them.
Yes, I just have to keep track of who I've given them to, you know, so that next time I give a gift, somebody doesn't go, oh, no, another speck worm.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to go for a break. We're going to go back from news. When we come back, we'll continue. Stay tuned. Just join. My name is Ismail Briava, and just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the Odyssey Midway 1548 in Satellite Islam. And to those of you that are still curled up in bed and on your patio having breakfast, we have a wonderful, wonderful guest, and that's Andrea Durham. I've come with lots and lots of information, and she shared some wonderful insights into trees. And we're now going to look at gardening for health. Now, many of us are saying, what benefits do we get out of gardening? Why should I be gardening? And now with all this, you know, water restrictions, we are in a water-scarce environment. Should I still continue gardening? And she's going to help us with some of those queries. Hi, good morning, Andrea. Thank you very much for being with us. And gardening for health. Tell us why gardening, why should we, and what is the benefits of gardening for health?
Oh, Oh, wow, you want me to talk at you for an half an hour without giving you a chance to even say anything. There are so many wonderful health benefits to gardening, apart from the physical exercise. Come on, you know, you get moving, your blood gets circulating, and we could then go into all the benefits of exercise, which are many. There's that element. There's also the element of stress relief. Stress relief, I think we have touched on it in a previous program, where researchers in countless research studies have found that people, even people suffering from severe stress and trauma, recover so much better when they have exposure to the activity that is gardening, being out there with the plants, working in the soil. It just seems to have such a wonderful calming effect on the mind. And tell me if there's anyone in this world nowadays that does not suffer from stress. And obviously that has health benefits again, because stress makes us ill. Then, of course, we can get onto the nutritional benefits. Poor nutrition is actually a bigger problem in today's world than many people realize. People think of obesity as being a huge problem. But what's very, very interesting is that a lot of people who are obese are actually undernourished, because they're not eating the right kind of things. They're not getting enough vegetables. They're not getting enough fiber. They're not even getting enough water. So, you know, you can look very well nourished and actually be undernourished. And all of these things can be really, really solved in the garden. And your veggie garden is an important part of that. Now, I hear what you're saying about drought and so on, and yes, there are water restrictions and we have to water by hand and so on, but we can actually do quite a lot with a relatively small area of ground if we're clever about how we sow our seeds, how we plant our seeds, and how we take care of our seedlings as they grow. We can actually get away with hand watering our veggie plots, as long as we don't obviously go and plant a whole hectare, which would perhaps be a little bit much to manage with a watering can. And then, of course, you get wonderful nutritional benefits, much better than you'd get from buying plants at shops, because these plants haven't, they're growing fresh out of the ground. You literally put them to the kitchen. And I mean, I was eating beetroots from my garden the other day. Beetroots, I mean, most people don't get excited about beetroots, you know, beetroots. But the flavor of these beetroots, just taken fresh out of the ground, rinsed off slightly, put on the brine in foil, allowed to cook in their own juices. It was absolutely delicious. Again, to grow in your garden, it's just so thick plants. They become under stress. And this is combated various ways. People put them in cold storage again, another time when vitamins and minerals and so on are lost. So really, there is just so much more nutrition in what you get out of your garden. Anyone who has done vegetable gardening before will vouch for the thing that what you've grown with your own hands, picked fresh out of your garden, always tastes freshest. The world's most famous chefs will all agree that fresh, locally grown produce is the way to go if you want to cook fabulous food with lots and lots of flavor. And of course, because it's so delicious, we like eating it. And, you know, you don't have problems with telling your kids, eat your vegetables, because the vegetables are actually quite nice.
You know, we spoke about both the physical and the nutritional benefits. Now, the physical benefits are definitely tremendous, and we found that, you know, in terms of health and going out there, just being alone with yourself, it's quite, you know, it's a unique experience, you know, just being alone in the garden and doing things. And I think, you know, it's very therapeutic as well, getting your hands dirty and so forth. So that's the physical. Now, we spoke about the nutritional. Now, many people will be saying, but what should we be planting and how much? And, you know, there's always it's been put that if you have the size of a door, you could feed a family of four. Take us through that process, because that's not a very big piece of ground that you need. You know, it's about, I'm just looking, about 1.5, would be about a meter by a meter, or meter and a half by a meter and a half, in which you can plant enough for a family of four. Take us through that.
I think that might serve a family of four for about 3 months. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not clever enough. I would do three doors, not just one, and I would stagger them so that they'd be ready at different times. I think the main mistake people make when they sow vegetables is they buy a packet of seeds and they sow the lot. I mean, they look at these seeds and they go, oh, this is never going to grow. I mean, I know there is just something about a seed that looks endlessly unpromising. The fact of the matter is that it probably will grow. And then you end up with hundreds of the things and you go, oh my goodness, well, I'd better plant them all, and you feel very bad. You don't want to throw away your little seedlings. And so you plant them all and they're all ready all at once. And then you have to either give it away or make plants freeze things and whatnot. And I think that's the mistake that a lot of people make. A lot of seeds never get sowed. People get very inspired, go and buy seeds, and then don't sow them. And then the ones that do tend to oversow. They put too much in at one time. So, for example, if you're growing sweet corn, and I made this mistake last year, so don't worry, if this is you, I honestly won't laugh at you. I got a whole packet of sweet corn seeds, and I sowed them all at once. But then it's okay, fine, it's October, lovely time this time of the year, in my area certainly, to sow sweet corn. And I put in my sweet corn seeds, and boy, did I have a wonderful crop. It was a bumper crop, and I could not possibly eat all that sweet corn. In fact, the moles actually managed to get in underneath, and I literally saw entire corn stalks being pulled under the ground, cobs and all.
So you've got lots of friendly neighbors.
I've got lots of very happy moles here. They're very, very happy. And, of course, now I'm tempting fate. I've sown them again on the same spot. But this time I've been a little bit cleverer. I'm going to stagger the spacing stagger the sowing about 2 weeks apart, so that not all my sweet corn is ready at the same time, because that was the problem that I had. It's actually incredible, the difference in flavor. And I know we've touched on this already, but specifically with sweet corn, I've noticed it. When you pick it fresh off the stalk and take it and cook it right away, as opposed to putting it in the fridge for a couple of days. So what I'm doing now is I'm sowing a few seeds a few days apart. And that's the trick with all of your things, your tomatoes, your onions, your carrots, your beetroots. I've slightly overdone it on beetroot, so I'm going to have to do some bottling. But that's okay, I can do that. Try not to have too much ready at once, which means sowing a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, every 2 weeks or so. So you'll have a sowing week, and then you'll wait 2 or 3 weeks and then have another sowing week. And so you'll stretch out your harvesting season over however many weeks you stretched out your seed packet. And that means if you now have young plants, older plants, so on, and as you get them, so you start putting them in your door-sized little plots. And you do mix and match. So you won't grow an entire door-sized plot full of tomatoes, for example. You'll plant, I would imagine, depending on the cultivar that you choose, but a nice free-bearing cultivar like Roma or Moneymaker or Floridade, I would say 4 plants is really ample for a family for a couple of weeks. And a couple of weeks later, a little bit more of that, but in the next bed, and so on and so on. So you've got this constant succession of vegetables coming to the garden. Composting, very vital, and especially during these times when we are a bit concerned about rain, when we're worried about drought, composting really, really helps the soil either to maintain moisture or to drain, because you also don't want it being too soggy. But specifically with water retention, in poor soil such as mine, I've got a very sandy, poor soil here, the composting helps with that. Mulching, definitely. Once your seedlings are up, you can mulch. Another way to save water, of course, is also the things that you don't have to sow direct, and I'm doing that this year. Things like tomatoes and things that don't mind being transplanted. If you sow them in trays, then during the early stage of germination, when they really need water, constantly moisture, then you have much better control, so you get better germination, and you also use a lot less water, because now instead of watering a whole patch of garden in order to get a couple of seeds nicely moistened, you've got your little tray of seedlings, which is not very big, that you sowed your seeds in, and you can actually, you know, water that using a lot less water than you would if it was in the... And I don't normally like to sow in trays when possible. It has to be sown direct. Sowing trays when possible. Keep your trays in the shade. This helps to boost it because, again, it limits drying out. So you don't get your plants suddenly decaying because you one day forgot to water them, which, as busy people, we're all prone to do from time to time. And then let them remain in the shade until they start making their first true leaves. So they'll come out with little cotyledons, which are the little seed leaves. You can see they're not really what the final leaf is going to look like. You see the first two leaves emerging. You can move your plants from light shade into sun. If you have them in deep shade, then take them from deep shade to light shade. You don't want to shock them, give them a nasty surprise. Let them harden off for about 2 weeks, and then they're ready for the next chop, which is transplanting, which you can then either do into old six-pack trays that you might have floating around. I've got quite a lot, as you can imagine. And I quite like doing that as well, because even after they've reached the sort of two-leaf stage, they don't need all the space that you have in your veggie garden. you're really saving water when you garden, when you grow your plants in trays, because you now are able to water more plants, less water if you're working on a smaller area.
Sorry, Andrea, you're breaking up. Could you just turn slightly so we can hear you clearly? I do apologize for that. Andrea, you're breaking up. We can't hear you at all, Andrea.
The longer you keep your seedlings in trays, the less water you use, the less food you use. If you use liquid seeds, which is normally quite expensive, you wouldn't want to use it on your open ground. So you can keep your plants better managed, better cared for, better watered, using less of everything. And then as soon as they're up and growing in a decent size, they're strong enough to go out into your vegetable garden, you can plant them out and give them that good layer of mulch that helps to keep the soil moist. And here I always say, water the soil well before you plant, and then water again after you plant, and then put the mulch on top. And that way you really, really will save water, because the mulch really keeps that moisture in. You won't have to be doing this every day, watering thing and so on. And you really just can do it with a watering can. The important thing after watering is to make sure that you've watered properly. So do give it a little time to soak in, and then go and get your hands dirty. Go feel the soil. It really is good for you.
Sorry, Andrea, just a couple of questions. The first one with regards to, you need more discipline when doing seeds as opposed to seedlings. Is that correct?
Yes. There's a pros and cons to everything. I love seeds because it's such a fun process doing it from start to finish. You do need a little bit more discipline because you need to pay attention to your seeds. Ideally, you should check them at least once a day. If you miss a day, if you're looking after the mice, it shouldn't be a train smash, but yes, they are a little bit more delicate, and you do need to take a little bit more care. Germination, that germination period, they have to be constantly moist. If you trigger germination and then allow things to dry out, they will die. That's the downside of seed. The upside of seed, it's a lot more economical. It works out much cheaper in the long run. Either way, growing plants from six packs or from seeds, you will pay a lot less than you will at the vegetable shop, and you will get much nicer food.
You spoke about three doors. Says you spoke about three door sizes. Tell us exactly how would you go about. Would you plant in each one of them, or would you first do the one and then go into out 2 weeks later, and then another 2 weeks later to the third patch? Would that be the way you do it?
You know, there aren't any really hard and fast rules, except that you do want to do some crop circulation. So just as a broad rule, if you've grown a root crop. After you've grown a root crop, you need to grow something that you eat another part of the plant. So maybe you grow a fruit crop, like a tomato or something like that. And then in your third season, you definitely need a legume to re-enrich your soil. That's sort of like just the natural circulation of them. Some people will say, for example, like we're talking about staggering the tomatoes, we'll say if you have a veggie garden, which is aimed for harvest at around about the same time, and then another little veggie garden that's aimed for harvest at around the same time, and a third little one. Some people will just do the one, and then sort of go from big to small. So you can sort of play around a little bit. But I think the most important thing about this that you will take home if you read a little bit more about this type of gardening is that the soil preparation is absolutely essential. And the main ingredient there is the organic. So in other words, your compost, your manure, whatever you're using to enrich your soil is a very, very important step. Depending on the type of soil you have, so for example, certainly when you have those hard red clay soils, you need to do some pretty deep digging. With hard soils, I say go 2 spades deep and mix in at least 1 spade of organic matter for every 2 spades of soil, so that when you put the soil back, you don't get that instant rock hard hardening of the soil again immediately afterwards. Fortunately, I don't have that problem right here, but I do have experience of soil that you hit with a pickaxe and the pickaxe bounces off the soil. So then you really, really need a lot of enrichment. But it comes down to the soil preparation. If you don't give your plants a good substrate to grow in, you are going to struggle.
Well, just a final question. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Is with regards to the herbs, whilst you're doing this, could it also be part of this, patches that you're talking about? And would they apply the same principles of staggering with herbs?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch any of that, Ismail.
Sorry, I said with regards to herbs, You know, would you apply the same principles, you know, that you stagger the herbs, or would you also plant them at one go? What would be a good idea? For example, you're planting basil or you're planting thyme. Would you plant it and sow it all at one time, or would you do it also staggering where you plant now and then a little bit later? Or what is the way you would do herbs?
Well, that's what it depends on the herbs. Chives, for example, when you're mainly harvesting the leaves, it doesn't really matter. You can sort of sow them all at the same time. They prevent you, they keep on growing. So once you've sown them, you've got them. And they sort of remain in your garden just about forever. So there, I'm afraid it doesn't really matter to stagger them. Thyme, another one, it's a perennial. So, you know, you can always refresh them by giving them a light trim, which is what you do anyway when you're harvesting it. So there, I don't find the staggering that important. But with the annual herbs, for example, basil, you may want to do the staggering of your crop so that you get them at different stages of growth. They need to be, basil in particular really sort of need to be a summer. So I'm starting to sow mine already. In fact, I sowed them last week, which was maybe even starting to be a little bit late. You could stagger them, because otherwise you have them all flowering and coming into seed at the same time. It can be an advantage or a disadvantage, because with basil you can prolong your plants by removing the flowering heads. I know they're very pretty, but once the plant is flowered and seeded, it will die. So keeping the flowers off is sort of a maintenance job that you do to keep your basil going a bit longer. But it remains an annual plant, and it will die down at the end of its growing year. So yes, then you could look at staggering. Personally, with herbs, not really so much.
Well, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the program. We have to leave it at that, and we'll chat to you again sometime in the future. You take care. Thank you very much, Andrea. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
And that was Arina Durham talking to us about planting vegetables and giving us some wonderful ideas of how we could do that. And, you know, there's always a debate about seed and seedlings. And I think that would be a case of our preference. And many people say, well, it's easier to plant seedlings, six packs. I do agree with that. But I think the joy, and if we're looking at the economics of things, to plant a seed, it would be far more inexpensive. That's all for me. I'm committed again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.